Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, welcome to The Tom Woods Show, episode 2427. I'm delighted to be joined by Andy Corbley, who has a brand new book called On the Face of It, A Traveler on His World. And of course, when you are a libertarian and you travel the world, you notice things that other people might not, and you have experiences other people might not have. At the same time, I refuse to be one of these libertarians who goes to the movies and has to critique every movie, or when his friend goes to see a movie, has to ask, was it a libertarian movie? I refuse to be that person. I insist on being a normal person who can just have normal experiences like everybody else. But all the same, this is still an angle that we will no doubt pursue. Andy is the founder of World at Large News, which you can check out at worldatlarge.news. Very easy to remember. Andy, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, it's no small pleasure, Tom. Thank you so much.
All right, let's dig into this because we not everybody listening enjoys travel. I understand that. I get it. Or they say, I can't afford it and all that. We'll get to that later. Even if you don't enjoy travel, we're going to have some insights that I rather suspect you will enjoy hearing. But let me start with this. I have a friend who's now deceased, who was very wealthy, but had no interest in going anywhere, had no interest in seeing the world. And you know why? He said, I can just buy a picture book and flip through it if I want to know what it's like to be in Morocco or in Vienna or somewhere. I can just flip through a picture book. There's something deeply impoverished about that way of thinking. What's your initial reaction when you hear that?
Well, my initial reaction is I think we can't imagine what we can't imagine. If we have no experience of a foreign land, how can we imagine that we've seen everything? And even if, let's put aside things like Yosemite Valley or things that you would see in said picture book, but there are just a trillion extra things that you either didn't know existed or you didn't know life could be carried out in that way. Because, of course, Earth is the domain of humans, and humans are curious creatures that can make living and habit out of almost anything. And so it goes back to what I said at the beginning, is that you don't know what you don't know. It's an unknown unknown, to quote our old deceased friend from the Bush administration. And so that's why you have to, well, you don't have to, but I think there's essentially no life or no profession that couldn't be improved by going and exploring the world for that very reason. You will almost inevitably, if you open your heart and your mind, find something that you didn't know existed that makes you a better person, a more rounded person, a richer intellect, a more broader skill set. So I got addicted to that. And I was just in Azerbaijan. And some of the things that they did there were also things I had never seen before, just things that the Azeri do that other people in the world don't do. And the things themselves weren't particularly amazing, but it adds up as you see more countries to this picture of a humanity that is just endless in its variety.
Well, my thinking is also that I think it's good for my children to see that not everybody thinks like you and not everybody lives like you, so that their minds can become expanded by realizing that there is a tremendous variety in cultures, lifestyles, worldviews, and you should know about that. It makes you a more informed person, more open-minded, more sympathetic to other people, less arrogant. So I think it has all these other qualities, apart from just the natural excitement of going somewhere you've never been. I mean, for my kids, even just going to England, which is probably one of the least exotic places for them, is still eye-opening because there are still little bits and pieces of the way they live and the way they talk and the way they do things that you wouldn't know about from a picture book or you wouldn't know about just from stories, you know, to experience them, to just walk around. I like going on guided tours as much as anybody. I like taking a bus around the city because I like to get a sense of maybe some of the things I'd like to spend more time on. But I also like just exploring. Here are five blocks, and I'm just going to crisscross them and see everything I can see entirely on my own. I mean, there's something thrilling and just irreplaceable about that. So that's kind of how I think. But let me jump in because I'm afraid if I let this get into too much of why you and I love to travel so much, folks who don't feel quite that way might not stay with us. But later on, I do want to talk about that. And maybe, even though I know this might not be your specialty, a little something about how you deal with the objection that I don't have the money to travel anywhere. There are ways, where there's a will, there's a way. We'll put it that way. But I want to skip ahead to page 63 of your book, because you're talking about what a nation is and a nation state. And you're noting that within political boundaries, you can very often find peoples and cultures who seem to exhibit all the characteristics of a nation, but they don't have their own state. And so we have this sentence: for anyone who cares about consistency of thought and policy, it's an extraordinarily difficult business determining exactly what that blend of cultural, linguistic, geographic, or historical characteristics must be in order to determine what changes a mere people into a nation, and which of those changes should be looked at as independence and which ones as rebellion. Boy, that was written like a libertarian right there. That's a beautiful sentence.
Boy, you have selected like my single favorite sentence in the whole book. And that was my favorite chapter to write because that's a subject I could talk about ad nauseum without end, 10 hours, no water, no nothing. It's for me the height of fascination. And it definitely was spawned by some of the early readings I did into libertarian authors.
Well, I can't tell you how happy I am to learn what a great sentence picker-outer I am. So give us one or two examples of a case like this, of a people like this, of the sort you're describing.
Well, in the book, I list just like what I thought of off the top of my head of every kind of disputed territory or city-state that had an independence movement, from Quebec to Tigray to Transnistria. But the two examples I use in the book, and I love this, is there's a people called the Dai, and there's like 65 million of them. They're an ethnic group that make up a cross-border area covering five countries, the north of Southeast Asia and the south of China. And they have their own, not necessarily their own language, but certainly a dialect. They have their own established canon of folklore. They have their own astrology charts, which puts the new year in June, which they celebrate with the world's largest water gun fight. And today there's no Dai country. They just exist as this people. And the unobservant traveler would notice no difference between the central of Thailand and the north of Thailand, where you can find these people. And that's when I started thinking, I learned about the Dai years ago, but it was when I was writing the book that I started thinking, well, what if the discussion was brought to the floor of the UN, let's say, what would the criteria be for that? As I write the book, the sentence you provided. And the other example is clearly the Basque, the people in southern France and northern Spain. And anytime anybody talks about southern France or northern Spain, they will inevitably mention that there is a mountain range there. It's called the Pyrenees. And on the Pyrenees, there are people that are really unique. Their language, they do have their own language. It's an isolate, which means its roots are unconnected to any existing language in the Indo-European family. They also pride themselves on being like the oldest civilization in Europe, and some genetic testing on very, very old skeletons have found that indeed the makeup of various minerals, the bones of Basques living today and the Basques that were living there something like 5,000 BCE is really quite similar. So there are these people. I also like to point out the Tigray, who fought a brutal war against the government of Ethiopia, whose president won the Nobel Peace Prize, ironically. And I remember when that kicked off, I was living in China at the time. And that was really, it was 2018, and it was really the earliest inklings of libertarianism that I had. It was also during a particularly horrible year in the conflict in Yemen. And I just remember thinking, I thought we had arrived at human society, that is. I thought we had arrived at a point where if a large section of a country say, we don't feel the government represents us and we would like to strike out on our own, I thought we were at the point where that was internationally respected. But, you know, really quickly, the government of Ethiopia launched a huge war there. And I don't know much more about the Tigray other than that a huge number of them decided quite unilaterally that they didn't want to be a part of Ethiopia. And it just started this kind of endless cycle in my head of thinking, well, what makes a people a culture and a culture a nation state? If Northern Italy, where I live, has many of its own dialects, Some of the people here look on the Southern Italians as if they're a different nation every once in a while, too. And so I often kind of prod my Italian friends like, well, you know, you guys pay taxes. It just goes to like support these cities and regions that have a completely different way of life for you. There's a bunch of problems, you know, obviously with the mafia, but I just always remember my uncle-in-law, my Italian uncle-in-law, he was recounting a trip in Napoli that he took in Naples. And his car, he was convinced by a local to leave it in a garage because if he left it in a parking lot, he was afraid it was going to get stolen. And when he came back from a trip to the Naples Islands, the car was untouched, except for the fact that the odometer had like 1,000, 2,000 extra kilometers on it. So it's obviously the people just took it for a joyride. And he just looks at me with this kind of puzzled expression with his teeth frozen. And he just goes, and he says in Italian, he's just like, they're not normal. So that was just one of these many examples. And I loved it so much writing the book about just thinking like endlessly, like what makes a people into a nation, etc. And so for me, I think it's got to be at least a language. UNESCO focuses a lot on dancing and culinary aspects, but when I was in Tunisia, for example, I met a lot of the Tamazi, which are the local non-Arab inhabitants of the North African kind of fertile region there. And one of them was actually referring to me. He was an artist, worked at the hotel I was staying at. He told me that his people are like an oppressed minority. And I just thought, oh, well, that's funny because a guy in Morocco also, told me something similar. He was a Tamazi as well. Or he was an Amazi, as they're called in Morocco. And I thought, well, why is there no Amazistan? And I asked him that. And he's like, well, it has this long history with French colonial thought. And the people who argued for revolution in North Africa took on this culture of French political revolutionary thought from the French Revolution. And it just resulted in this absolute catastrophe where we sacrificed all of our economic freedoms for political ones, which were meaningless because they were all suppressed by dictators anyway. And I thought, wow, he's pretty smart. In any case, so it is a fascinating situation that you encounter almost everywhere around the world, from Texas to Tigray to Transnistria.
Well, it seems like it really is just a matter of historical happenstance, because there are obviously plenty of peoples who have at least as good a claim on nationhood as many existing nations do. And it's just the way events unfolded. Now, there's so many things that make me curious when I travel. I like to, as I say, I like to know about the culture, the place I'm going to. And that the word culture, I include that as an umbrella term that covers so, so many different things. And it includes a kind of a sense of their worldview. Now, if I look in the U.S., it seems like we have competing worldviews within one place. But I wonder if that's always true. I have a sense that there are plenty of Asian countries where everybody doesn't agree on every single thing. Or you know what, even let's abstract even from Asia. And let's just recall, there was an economist in the UK who probably died maybe 15, 20 years ago, Peter Bauer. And he was interested in the subject of foreign aid and the development of the third world. And he found that foreign aid was not helpful and that if anything, it was harmful. But another thing he found was that there really were certain people whose cultural presuppositions were hostile to entrepreneurship, were hostile to economic development. And his view was, until you get rid of these bad ideas, all the money we send you is going to go right down the toilet. It's not going to accomplish anything. So the thing is, if I travel, do I meet enough people to be able to get a representative sample of how they all think? I doubt it. But in the course of your travel, has your little, the libertarian side of your brain turned on when you're talking to people and thought to yourself, wow, this culture has a real independent streak to it, or this culture has more of a collectivist streak to it? Does that ever happen?
Yeah. Do you know what happens first is I find myself pulled more to a plane of essential humanity at first. And it actually can take me a while to even put on a pair of libertarian glasses, if you like, because you're coming to a strange country. You're fortunate enough, if you're talking with someone, if you're invited into a house, if you're having a coffee with someone, you want to first make yourself as approachable and amicable as possible. You don't want to appear like an aloof, ignorant foreigner. I don't tend to have much of a problem with that, but it is, for me, first about connecting on a human-to-human level. And on that plane, I find that most people are incredibly the same. But one of the wonderful contradictions, travel brings up a lot of really fun contradictions that kind of play in your mind like Zen poetry. And one of them is, yes, we are all the same on that kind of fundamental plane of existence. For example, the consistency with which people recognize that I am not the actions of my government is extremely encouraging, because we Americans, maybe because we do it, have a fear that we will be associated with the actions of our government. But that is literally never the case. I mean, I haven't been held up by like an Iranian border patrol agent. And maybe that would be a case where I would be associated with the actions of my government. But that is almost, it's almost uniquely dismissed by people. And that's basically because they don't want to be associated with the actions of their government. When it comes to libertarianism and rights and economic activity, I do find less that cultures adopt this sort of, but more I can pick it out in the society so fast. Like, for example, I had the great fortune and perhaps wherewithal to go to Ukraine in April of 2021. And I was able to see the country a year before the war began and what society was like. Because in my opinion, journalistic opinion, I would say the society there will be pretty much different for a good few generations. And so I was able to see. And one of the things that struck me immediately was the amount of I learned to read Cyrillic, and the word in Cyrillic for public notary is about the same as it is in English. It's like notary. But they were everywhere. They were like 7-Elevens, public notaries. And I remember thinking like, that indicates to me that it is a society where a lot of paperwork needs to be done, right? And so sure enough, I asked the hotelier, I love hoteliers. They're always wonderful sources of information, especially regarding the regulatory environment in any given country. And she told me immediately that, yes, it is almost impossible to proceed with any paperwork filing within a 1 month period, because it just stretches on and on. And part of the reason why is because of their over-reliance on public notaries for all documents. But Ukraine obviously has this huge history of corruption. So it's not so much that I detect it or don't detect it in the makeup of the society's culture, but it is something that you can see rather quickly stratified onto that through regulatory environment or whatever level of government overreach that there is in the economy. If I had to say one particular society that is desperate for some more entrepreneurialism and really susceptible to that ideas is Ghana. I actually received an invitation to deliver an economics lecture, which I am not accredited to do at a, what would it be? It would be, I think, a Presbyterian church in Ghana by a friend of mine who he asked me why we had a bigger, like a nicer house and more money than him. And I realized like, oh, I have to explain like, colonialism and free market and Adam Smith and Daniel Ricciardo. And like, I had to think of all of it and this whole history of our laissez-faire capitalism and kind of condense it into this tiny form. And I managed to do it in a 7-minute audio message. And he was like, he said to me, the people in my country would be desperate for this information if they knew it existed. So that was like really encouraging to me, because Africa is obviously has had enormous challenges, but they have very great entrepreneurial minds there. And my other job, actually, I founded World at Large. Indeed, I work writing every day for that publication. But my other job is at another online news outlet called the goodnewsnetwork.org. And it's the world's number one source for positive journalism. And we are always doing stories about Africans who are not so far above the poverty line, who are coming up with great ideas, recycling laptop batteries to make EV bikes or to reduce air pollution in the huge megacities like Nairobi and Kampala and places like this. So the African mind is a very entrepreneurial one. And I think free market economics could take very strongly, especially in the Anglophone. That's another thing too, is because Africa, so much of Africa, unfortunately, is divided between kind of French language, civil law and French economic thought, and English common law and English economic thought. And you can kind of track the disparities in economic productivity and development quite clearly onto those differences in language and culture. And that makes for a great example. My friend in Ghana, Kwadjo, he's a banker. We had this conversation, and he essentially confirmed to me that in the West African Economic Union, it's always the English colonized states that today are the producers and the lenders, whereas it tends to be the ones that speak French practice civil law, which I also think is a big aspect to it. They tend to be the ones that are always borrowing, always in trouble, getting their governments thrown, always in debt, can't produce anything, have some huge burden of regulation. So it's more something that you witness in the society that is on top of the culture, but not so much in the culture itself.
You know, it's funny. I was planning to ask you a question that you more or less addressed just there, which was, I know you live in Italy, but everybody would think of you as an American. And I wondered, because sometimes the American empire can come off as arrogant. And are you treated that way? Now, I've found that people seem to love Americans no matter where I go. I was in, again, this is not particularly exotic place, but I was in Scotland, and the taxi driver was so happy to be talking to an American, because he told me that he remembered when his family took a trip to Orlando and what it meant to him and how meaningful it was to be able to do that for his family. And I thought, okay, whereas I'm over here thinking, you know, you guys, your architecture and everything is so much more impressive than ours. I'm glad we were able to give you some enjoyment. But I wondered about that, particularly because my wife has an interest in visiting what we might call forbidden places, places that the regime is not on good terms with. So Iran, for example, or Cuba or places like that. And I was wondering about that. And especially as the rhetoric between the countries heats up, does that get taken out of the tours? It's interesting to hear you say that you've never experienced that.
Yeah, not a single instance. There was one time where I was in Nicaragua, which is a country that has received particularly harsh policy from the United States, where there was a guy who was really quite short with me. But because I was deliberately asking, I actually arrived in the country on the 40th anniversary, I think it was the 40th anniversary of the Sandinista takeover of the nation, for which the Contras were funded by Reagan to overthrow, or Nixon, I can't remember. But I was asking him about it, and he was quite short with me. So, but it never, that was just a cab driver, but it never came off as hostile. It just came off as, you know, maybe like the kind of tone you take when you don't really want to start a political discussion with somebody. You want to try to close it before it begins because you're worried it will cause tension in the situation. You mentioned Cuba, though. A man I quote in the book, and perhaps we'll quote again in this interview, Henry Rollitz, who was a huge inspiration of mine for traveling. He went to Cuba, and he described Cuba as feeling like, even after all of the maltreatment they've received from various United States regimes, they consider themselves our little brother. And I just thought, wow, that's just beautiful. And he describes this beautiful situation where he's in a taxi, again, taxi. Taxi drivers, you can learn so much from. He is just trying to communicate, just trying to remember whatever scrap of elementary school English he picked up, a word he saw in a book sometimes, and he just says, America. And Henry Rollins returns to him. He's like, Cuba. And then the guy just says, baseball. And Henry Rollins was like, oh, run. And then in his live show, Henry Rollins was like, I was convinced that the cab driver and I, we could have resolved the whole 60-year conflict between our two nations right there. We had it all worked out in the cab. And that really is the feeling. And speaking of other forbidden nations, I've been very lucky to speak with some real, first words in my book are, I am not like one of the super endless travelers because I took a different path in life. But I have been fortunate to interview them and talk to them. Some of these old timers who have gone through 7-8 passports, or young guys who have some blessed career that allows them to work very little from their computer and no wife and no kids, and they just go, go, go. And they too have met. I'm actually compiling interviews for a second book about human kindness And they, to a person, have said that where have they received inordinate kindness beyond the mere giving of directions or, you know, directing to the law, to the right train platform, to the obviously lost tourist? Where has it gone really out of the way? And to a man, it's Iran, it's Iraq, it's Sudan, you know. And I've heard that my whole life, not just in the compiling of this other book. So I think I'm confident when I say that it's something that never comes up. Americans are just, you know, just a pronoun. You are just an American. You are not the manifestation of all things that everybody knows America does in the world. You know, and even I've even had people bring up the penchant for starting wars around the world, but it's almost more like it's a real shame. And I'll go, yeah, man, it really is a shame. But not an ounce of it is directed at me.
Hey, everybody, quick message on behalf of our sponsor, Monetary Metals. You have almost certainly heard Ron Paul say that the thing that got him into politics was Richard Nixon closing the gold window in 1971. And ever since Nixon definitively took us off the gold standard, things have just gotten worse. The dollar has lost over 90% of its value since that time. It's become harder for Americans to retire. The national debt just surpassed $33 trillion. Disaster can strike at any time. And so we need a change. Where's that change going to come from? Not from DC. It has to come from the market. We need a market-based answer to the corrupt, dishonest money we use today. And I think we have one. That answer is Monetary Metals. Monetary Metals enables you to get on your own personal gold standard starting today. Who cares what the Federal Reserve is doing with interest rates when you can earn interest on your gold paid in gold? Earn up to 5% in their gold leasing program or earn double-digit returns in their gold bonds if you're an accredited investor. I've put my own money, my gold, where my mouth is and opened an account with them myself. It's time for you to do the same. Join me and our old friend Jeff Deist as we lead an honest money revolution that starts by opening an account at Monetary Metals today. Go to monetary-metals.com/woods to learn more. That's monetary-metals.com/woods. I'll tell you this story. And by the way, I absolutely mortified one of my daughters a few months ago. We were in London over Independence Day, July 4th. And so that's, you know, maybe perhaps, I don't know, a source of awkwardness between the two countries. I don't know. I've never been abroad on July 4th. And we got out of the taxi that day and somebody from the hotel was greeting us and they said, Happy Independence Day. And I said, we never should have left. Just for the heck of it. No one's ever said anything like that to them before. My daughter could not believe those words exited my mouth. But it was interesting because it was an Indian-owned hotel. So the Indians also have a history with the British. So it really was okay for them to wish me that. But I still couldn't help myself being a troublemaker. I want to read a couple of things one at a time here from your book that struck me.
Great.
The first one, we can just pass by because, I mean, it's rhetorical, sure, but with its insight. But then I want to go to something I had never thought of before. So the first one is, governments make their citizens believe the world is more complicated than it seems, and for that reason, we need their guidance and protection. It is because the world is actually much simpler than it seems that we need neither. Only a government could make free trade legislation that spans 15,000 pages when 15 words would suffice. So that's the first one. But here's the second one. I never thought about this before. You say, here can be found one of the contradictions of travel. One wants to go touring, but one doesn't want to be a tourist. One wants to support those who practice their traditional arts. But the thought that they do so only for tourists is unpleasant to hear. It conjures questions. Can something actually be traditional if the people who invented it merely continue to practice it for the purpose of amusing foreigners with deep pockets? Isn't that a form of neocolonialism? If indeed that is the sole reason for an activity's continued existence, isn't it actually a good and potentially noble thing to support it then, since it would be a shame for the world and future generations to lose it? Contrarily, is the survival of an activity by way of the tourist's dollars a kind of cultural repression that prevents new cultural expressions that could become traditions in the future? Now I'll never look at this the same way again. And you say in there that you don't have a neat potted little answer to this, but that's an interesting conundrum.
Yeah, I mentioned already in this interview about contradictions, and psychologically disturb the human mind because they stand out as so blatantly unusual. And Nietzsche had a great line where he said quite simply, es denkt in mir, which means, to use it in the context that he was using it, it means something is thinking in me. And that was really describes the process of coming up with this concept, because it didn't feel like I had this thought. It felt like something, it came to me quite on its own. Something was thinking in me. And I just couldn't square it that, yeah, there are so many beautiful handmade products here in these markets in North Africa. Are any of them actually used in the houses of the people that sell them, or do they buy plastic Chinese imports like the rest of us? And as I meant, yeah, as you've just mentioned there, there's no right or wrong answer to it, but we have this unfortunate situation where the less of these traditional aspects a country or a culture has, the less generally interesting they are as destinations, which puts me, who really cares about intellectual consistency and sympathetic consistency as well, in an awkward position, because I'm like, well, if the only reason I would go to this place is, for example, let's use the example of the cormorant fishermen are so famous from China, these men who paddle on the river, big rivers in Guilin, on these book rafts, and they have trained cormorants to go diving for fish. And it's a traditional method of fishing that goes back thousands of years that today is practiced only for tourists. Now, aside from the fact that the whole Guilin is a beautiful place, stunning, one-of-a-kind scenery in the world, but let's just say that fishing activity was done on a totally normal river without any special mountain ranges and rice paddies around it. You would undoubtedly skip that region in your itinerary if the cormorant fishermen swapped their cormorants for longlines. And that's not a particularly kind decision, because those people are interesting and they have stories to tell and they have other cultural elements that are worth seeing. But we have only so much time in our lives and can only absorb so much information. And so for us, the only thing we know about these people is that they fish with cormorants. And if they didn't fish with cormorants, we wouldn't know about them. We would never shake their hand. We would never have the opportunity to be invited into their house for tea. It's just a really uncomfortable contradiction that you have to face, that even if you want to travel the world with a kind heart and to do the right thing, you kind of have to constantly balance between, am I doing this solely for my amusement whilst these people are stuck in a kind of, you know, like, for example, in Namibia, I was told by this old time traveler that anyone you see wearing traditional garb, they're all just wearing that for tourists. If they're at home, they're in Levi's. And he said, the only chance you can get is if you go out to find the sand bushmen, but you won't find them because they're real hunter-gatherers and they're too aware of people trying to look for them and they stay clear, right? So you have this really unfortunate thing where you're like, I don't want to just support their hanging around desert, you know, people, let's say in North Africa or West Africa, hanging around deserts, riding camels all day with sand in their shoes. And like, they don't get to enjoy the comforts of civilization because they have to make a living and they have to do that by like remaining in the 17th century. And if they didn't, then I wouldn't see them and they wouldn't make any money and I wouldn't get to know them. And that's just a really unfortunate thing that I've had to confront many, many times. And, you know, part of the reason I wrote this book was because there were enough of these kind of manifestations of thought that I didn't want to dilute them with another 5 to 10 years of thoughts from traveling. I wanted to collect them in a way that would show them off because I thought that they were really important. And that maybe some travelers would like to hear them and see them put into words specifically in a way that perhaps they themselves aren't able to because they don't have, you know, years of writing experience or whatever education and cultural influence that I've had that allows me to have these insights spontaneously while I'm wandering the globe.
Yeah, you definitely have written a book that I could not have written, and not simply because I'm not nearly as well-traveled as you are. In terms of what you just said about people having to be stuck in the 17th century because they have to make a living, and there is all this tourist demand for them to live in the 17th century, I definitely hear what you're saying. The way I guess, deal with that in my mind is to say, as their country develops economically, they're going to be needed more in other areas of the economy. And that's going to pull them away. It's not going to be, you couldn't offer them enough money to stay in the 17th century once their country develops. Now, that's the big once, because we have a lot of developing countries, which, as you, I think, said in the book, let's say we use the, this is my little spin on it, but we use the word developing, I think, sometimes as a euphemism, because plenty of these countries, I'm sorry to say, are not developing in any way that we would recognize. We would not really use that word if it weren't customary in these situations. So I realized
have
that.
Have you read, you mentioned aid earlier and Peter Bao, the economist. You read William Easterly's book?
I have, yes. I mean, he's saying very largely the same kind of things.
Yeah. There's another one in there on my reference page is Dead Aid, about specifically Africa, but it was written by an African, and that's a really powerful book. But
wasn't it interesting to hear Bono from U2 come out and say, you know, it turns out this foreign aid doesn't really work the way we wanted it to. And that's very sweet and everything, but we did try to tell him, and we did try to tell him there are a lot of books on this that you might want to look into before you dive in. And that by the time he was into it in the 1980s, the consensus was this doesn't really do any good. It's counterproductive for a lot of reasons. He just wouldn't listen because he had to be morally pure and all that. That's a separate matter. But my other thing is the question I always ask myself when we're talking about people who are very poor and what they do for a living, it always is, what's the alternative? So yes, of course, in a fantasy world, I'd like them to be doing something super fulfilling, which they don't have to feel like they're just play acting or whatever. But this apparently must be the best choice they have since they chose it. And so for the time being, obviously they have determined for themselves that anything else they do would be worse. And I have to just console myself with that.
Well, you know what? To support that conclusions positive note, I did notice there was a stark contrast. Now I'm beginning to circle around to countries that I've already talked about here, but between Morocco and Tunisia, they were both controlled by French. They both used civil law systems. They both achieved independence at relatively the same times. And Morocco has the very pleasurable position of being able to retain a lot of its traditional culture while enjoying development rates higher than that of Tunisia. In Tunisia, I found a culture that seemed eager to distance itself as much as possible from any kind of pre-colonial past. And in Morocco, it really lies thick in the air. I mean, you get people wearing traditional clothing to work, and that's when you know you're really in a pretty unique part of the world, because, you know, jeans and a t-shirt that's pretty much standard for everywhere. And you still get people in Morocco going to work on a cold morning in a jalaba, which is the traditional kind of Jedi knight looking robe with the hooded robe that they've worn for years. But in Tunisia, there's none of that. There's no traditional food. There's no traditional elements in their modern, you know, their recently constructed architecture. So you are correct to suggest that because they are doing it, it must mean that it's the best choice economically for them. And that can also mean it can sometimes be such a good choice that it can actually provide for a relatively comfortable 21st century life, cloaked as it may be in the garb of ages past. Whereas Tunisia, I felt the burden of poverty was way more visible, as well as the modernity. So it isn't always as uncomfortable as the contradiction in my book paints it to be.
Let's finish with a few lightning round questions. So like less than a minute, even though I know you could go on for 10 years, less than a minute if you can for each of these. Why are you living in Northern Italy rather than here in the US?
I finally found a job that allowed me to work on a computer. And so I left everything behind, went to Africa. And within 2 weeks, I met the woman who would become my wife. She was Italian.
And there you are. But that, okay, that's great. So now you have extra time you can use on the other answers. That's the time is cumulative, I've decided, in this particular
lightning
round.
That's good.
All right.
That one I've told a few times, you may imagine.
Yeah, I have no doubt. The next one is, what about somebody who says, I'd love... First of all, let me start by saying, you can get your feet wet by traveling around the U.S. to start with. There are a lot of wonderful places in the U.S. and a lot of great, unique experiences you can have in a lot of these places. If you just poke around a bit, you'll be surprised. But then that will get you hungry for going beyond the borders of the U.S. And I think the most common thing people might say is, there's no way I can make this happen. Assuming I could get the time off, where would I get the money for this? International travel is quite, they might think, is quite expensive. Now, I'd like to know, first of all, what your thought is about that. And then I have to go look at my email inbox for a second, because I think I have another suggestion of my own. So what are your thoughts? Do you have any? I mean, maybe this isn't your thing.
Yeah, first of all, depending. Yeah, you go.
Oh, no, I know. I'm saying maybe this isn't, I'm asking you to give people this guide. I don't even know if this is something you know
about. Yeah. So depending on where you live in the U.S., you have access international travel immediately to Central America, which is, most people think of Mexico as the whole thing. But there's a lot of different kinds of experiences that you might not imagine in Central America that don't just involve the beach or being attacked by, you know, drug cartels or whatever. You know, there's plenty of civilization to enjoy. There's also plenty of, obviously, natural wonders in places like Costa Rica and Guatemala. Guatemala and Belize. I mean, Belize is like trilingual. They speak English, they speak Spanish, and they speak a form of Creole, which they also speak in Nicaragua, actually. So you can fly to Central America for, you know, under $400, and then travel in Central America. You're talking about pennies on the dollar in terms of the local currency. Fortunately for them, unfortunately for the traveler, a lot of these countries have started to just pair one-to-one to the greenback. So it's not as easy as it once was. Another opportunity would be to go to small countries. Yeah, maybe you have to fly overseas, but you fly to small countries clustered together. So an example of that would be like West Africa, or not so much Southeast Asia, because Southeast Asia is bigger than you think. And also the plane tickets there are really expensive. But Northern Europe, Belgium, the Netherlands, Danzig, Northern Germany, Estonia, those are all kind of, you know, in a lot of, or no, Estonia's north, sorry, Latvia or Lithuania, most southern one, where you can make several border crossings on foot in the allocated time of your, so those would be two examples in a way to travel, you know, inexpensively. Obviously, you can just go to the most poor, dirt, you know, poverty level waged country in the world where your dollar will go really, really far. That's how most broke Americans traveled. But some of those countries, you have to pay $1,200 in plane, you know, in airfare upright to reach. Another great way is by my friend Thor Pedersen, the Danish traveler. He just asks cargo ship operators if he can just join the cargo ship's trip from Africa to South America to drop cargo on, you know, at Rio de Janeiro or whatever, and you'll just disembark with the cargo. Now, that's not something that everybody's going to do, and some countries hate that. They consider it, you know, illegal, or not necessarily illegal, but malintentioned, you know, entry into their country. But those are three methods that you can travel the world relatively inexpensively as an American.
Well, the thing I was looking for, I found it instantly. The thing I was looking for is a service I use. Now, I remember paying $25 for it. I don't think it's more than that. But don't be disappointed if it's more. And it's called nextvacay.com. So next and then VACAY.com. And we all know that airfares are quite variable. You know, they can be $400 difference depending on just a matter of a few months. And this service keeps an eye on all of them for you and then emails you when great deals arise. And they're not great deals that you have to take it, you know, you have to fly 5 days from now. They'll say, we found some great deals between your home airport and, you know, Bogota or something in January or February. You may have to book it within the next couple of days, but you don't have to fly for several months. At this point, I don't remember how many I'm getting, but every other day or so, I get an email from them. And I don't always want to go to these places, but I like to know that I have this service that is automatically finding me the most economical way to get from A to B. So that's a service to consider. NextVacay.com.
And that is really reflective of how desperate the airline industry can become sometimes to sell tickets. I remember speaking to an economist from Canada when I was in Namibia, and he was explaining to me a story about when he lived and was working at universities in East Asia. And he was saying he would regularly be on flights and pay so little. And he would start to ask people like, did you pay this price? And the next passenger next to him would be like, yes, I paid. And he would get, you know, five or six people, and he would say, okay, well, I know that it costs about $110,000 to get this plane from A to B. And we all paid $48 for this ticket. So if a plane has to leave, it has to leave. I mean, you can't just like interrupt schedules if there's no huge problem, right? So airlines can become absolutely desperate. And if you're feeling, if you have spare time and you really are trying to travel the world, you can show up at an airport and ask for last minute flights. And they can practically be giving tickets away because they have to leave and they have no other choice but to sell a ticket today. And so they'll mark tickets down enormously. But generally, that's cool that you can find a service to do that online. I have only ever heard of people being able to do that at the airport ticket counter, which I myself never used, being a child of the internet age.
Well, so, these deals might not be as rock bottom as what you're getting at the airport, but they're still pretty good. So I'm always alert to them. So that's definitely been helpful. What is the 1 minute pitch for why I shouldn't stay in my hometown my whole life? Now, by the way, you can live in your hometown, no problem. But in terms of why I should go somewhere, at least for a visit.
Well, it goes back to that thing I said at the beginning. It's all unknown unknowns. You don't know how beautiful the world is because you don't have the capacity to imagine something that you have no feeder information. You have no Lego bricks to construct an image of a tepui in South America. You know, these islands amid the cloud forests where waterfalls fall down from everywhere. And the people you meet is the same case. You don't know what the people in XYZ town are. Like in China's society is so different that you could almost make the case that they view something like bare matter, just plain regular material world, as different than you do. And you just wouldn't know how to imagine that because a lot of people can live their whole life on it. But if you don't have fuel for your imagination, then you can't kind of make it work. And there's no profession that couldn't be improved. No, if you work with your tongue, if you're a lawyer, if you work with a pen, if you're a writer, there's no profession that couldn't be improved by exposing yourself to some relevant condition that you would find in another country. And there was a samurai who lived 400 years ago, and he said in so many words that there is a way, there is an art in everything. And the more ways that you learn, the better you'll be in everything. And travel is certainly informs you in all those little arts to doing things. And it just, I would be such a lesser person without my travel experiences. And that doesn't necessarily only include the fact that I'm now a wife and a father because of traveling. Or the fact that I've launched my career, I wrote this book, I started this website, all of the things, all of the decisions I made in my life, I learned Chinese, whatever. Italian, learned Italian, I'm fluent in Italian. All of that came from traveling. And I think the best way, I've already used a few analogies to finish this 1 minute pitch, is if you throw a small stone into a pond, it will create small ripples. The ripples will bring very little back to you. If you throw a very large stone into the pond, the ripples across life and society are much bigger, and they bring more necessarily back to you. And so that's just why travel is the biggest stone that you can throw in a pond. It's casting yourself out into the world.
I like that. I like the sound of that. Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Persist SEO. If you are getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO. If you are a small local business trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, then increase your visibility with Persist SEO. What if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis? Well, then website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. Are you tired of cold calling and networking, meeting places getting shut down? Use your website as a lead generation engine. Or what if you're not showing up for your services in the search engines? will get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. I guess I have one more little suggestion, and it's not going to save you $1 billion on travel, but it saves me a few bucks, and so I use it. So there's a service, it used to be called Ebates, which that was a brilliant name. And then they renamed it to something so terrible, I'm not even going to tell you what it's called anymore. But the idea of it is, all these companies that you deal with on a daily basis. So you think, I mean, I use Orbitz for all my travel because I'm a platinum member. I get all these benefits. I'm not using anything other than Orbitz. But you know, you might order flowers for somebody, and so you use an online florist if the person's halfway across the country, or you know, you order something from Best Buy, whatever. Oh, there are a lot of major retailers that you do use, or there are restaurants that you go to, whatever it is. This particular company basically joins the affiliate programs of all these big companies. A lot of times these affiliate programs are not open to the public, and it shares the revenue with you. So if I, let's say I use Instacart, Instacart, it's only a 1% cash back, not a lot, but I spend $300 on groceries from Instacart, I get $3 back for doing nothing. I was going to order from Instacart anyway. But sometimes it can be 5%, 3%, 4%. So on Orbitz, it fluctuates between 3 and 5%. Every single thing, all the hotels, the rental cars, whatever. So at the end of the month, I'm just making ordinary purchases that I would already. But every 6 to 8 weeks, I get a check for like $300. I mean, I'm not going to retire in Hawaii on that, but why would I not want the $300? You know, it doesn't make any sense. So I'm not going to say the ridiculous name, but I have a link that takes you there because it really, as I said, I use it all the time. My wife uses it. And then we compare who has the bigger check when it comes in the mail. Fun. So you can get there, tomwoods.com/doing-nothing. And I deliberately put doing nothing because I know that'll antagonize people who think this can't possibly be real. It is real. A ton of people use it. It's just I'm already doing these things. I want to make them as inexpensive on myself as possible. And so this summer, we went to Hawaii as a family. All five daughters, the wife and I, all of us. That was not cheap.
What a haul.
So it was really nice to get that big check from this
because that's a good point.
I made all the arrangements through it. So anything you can do to save yourself a few bucks, especially when it comes to travel, has to be considered.
Just like just to top that up, add to that is like a travel rewards credit card. I mean, I only take, with my commitments as a father and a husband, I only take about 2 trips a year these days. And I can't remember the last time I paid for a hotel. I just use the rewards.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So definitely that. I join every rewards program there is. Now, I find that rewards programs for hotels take a long time to accumulate. Maybe it's because I'm not staying in the same hotel chain often enough.
That's also difficult, too, because the Radisson in Baku might cost an awful lot more than the Radisson in Bamako, Mali, you know. So maybe you're like, oh, I'll join the Radisson Rewards program because I'm in this really cheap country. And then you were like, oh, I have the Radisson Rewards program. I'll stay at the Radisson. Oh, it's $447 a night. So.
Right. Right. But anyway, all right. Well, one of these days, because it's a kind of side thing of mine, maybe I'll do a little travel thing with an ebook opt-in on, you know, how to travel on a budget or whatever. I mean, because sometimes I do, and other times I could write an ebook on how to splurge like a complete idiot on your trip. But
I always thought, there is a bucket of money to be made by someone who could write an ebook on travel where in between the pages, they could have clips from a video log. If anyone could do that, they'd make, like in terms of like travel tips, they'd make a lot of money, I think. Because my friend has a great log service and I'm like, if only you could condense these down into a guide that people who don't follow, you know, like don't spend time on YouTube could access.
Well, I have told people at my various webinars and stuff multiple times that I would opt in instantly for any travel service or blog or anything whose opt-in gift was get our free guide to traveling with young children. Oh, I would love to read that because it is a challenge. And your friends who don't have children don't understand what the problem is. Well, why don't you come visit us? It's a simple thing. You just come visit us. You have no idea what's involved. You have no idea what you're asking of me here. So I would like to have whatever tips.
Which age group did you find the most difficult? Because we went to Sardinia for our summer vacation. We took my four-month-old son, and he was perfect. I mean, aside from the most catastrophic diaper emergency before we took off, but after we had boarded. Aside from that, he was a dream. He was perfect. But then I thought, I wonder if this is actually the easier part, because you can just kind of manipulate him and control him.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I didn't get the travel bug until way later. So I'm just talking about driving from one state to another, you know, or like that's four states away or something like that, or getting on a plane for an occasional short trip. So I have no idea. I have no idea what international travel would be like. But it's just a matter, it's not that they were bad kids. It's just that, you know, I'm sitting here doing nothing for 6 hours, you know, and then occasionally one of them just gets upset, you know, and when you have five, you know, like, yeah, you know, but on the other hand, eventually they get to an age where they can take care of each other and that helps. So we'll see. I mean, my future may yet involve still more children. And in this case, they are going to be jet setters and we are going to figure this out and we are going to train them to have more sophisticated palates than I have, because sometimes we go to another place and I say, I don't want to eat that. And my wife thinks, what are you, seven? I mean, come on. You know, yeah. They're not going to serve you an American meal everywhere you go. You have to be open-minded and try things. So she's a good influence on me.
It only occurred to me a few days ago when I was speaking with my butcher here in Northern Italy. I was like, yeah, I guess I have eaten a lot of weird things, but it kind of snuck up on me. It's just part of blending in. It never like stuck out to me that this was something unusual.
Yeah.
Or maybe it did at the time, but then I started to think and I'm like, boy, I really have like knockbacks of weird things.
Yeah. Or even just unexpected things. Like right outside our hotel in Madrid earlier this year, there was a place with a line stretching forever and it was a calamari sandwich with no sauce on it. It was just calamari and bread and everybody went berserk for it. You would never think that. And so we tried it and it was not offensive, but there was nothing particularly special about it. These people would have slit your throat to get themselves a calamari sandwich. Who even knows? Anyway, let me let you go. But
I want to say one more thing, which is, and you just reminded me of it, which is that people who listen to this show should take your travel advice because you have a discerning taste, Woods. You singled out a few episodes ago Spain as an underrated destination.
Yes.
And
not
Madrid or Barcelona, but Spain. And you've got good instincts to think that because each region of Spain really is special on its own right. And it's not recognized as a regional country the same way in that France and Italy are very regional. But no, it's just as good regionally speaking.
I've been to Spain several times, and every time I leave, I think I want to come back and explore more of it. So we still intend to do that. But as I've told Mikkel Thorup, who is the great world traveler who hosts the Expat Money Show, the problem we wind up with is deciding, do I go back to places that I love, or do I go explore a new place, given that time is finite and my resources are finite? There are places I'd love to go back and visit. I just love dearly. But yet that explorer in me wants to go to that new place. And, you know, it's the struggle we all have to endure.
Oh, well, it's eternal. It'll never go away.
No, it won't. I'm quite sure it won't. To check out your book, On the Face of It, A Traveler on His World. I will link to it in the description of the video. Or if you're listening, just audio, it's tomwoods.com/2427. Andy, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sal. It was a great pleasure.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.